It's that time of the year again when your nice hosts take a few weeks off. The show will be back with new episodes at the end of February, but each week until then, we will be re-airing some of our favorites from 2024. This week's nice replay is episode 371, Tutorialization with Puzzles, with Luke Spirevka, originally published November 1st, 2024. I chose this interview for a nice replay because I think we can all work on improving our game tutorials, except Luke and the Afterburn team, because they totally have it figured out. So I want to listen again and let it really sink in.
When you say we can all, are there anyone in particular you're thinking of when you say that?
Everyone.
Everyone.
I said exactly what I meant.
Okay. That's fair. I mean, I could speak for myself when I say that I would like more help with tutorials, and this episode was really helpful for that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was really fascinating to hear like all the different perspectives on how puzzles influence a player's perspective on the game.
Yeah, yeah.
It was really cool.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's just a great example of just the stellar run of interviews we had in 2024.
Absolutely.
A wide variety of topics. Yeah. So even if you've heard this one already, it's worth re-listening for sure.
Mm-hmm.
For sure. So the show will be back with new episodes at the end of February. While you wait, you can get these nice replays and all of our episodes ad-free, plus exclusive bonus audio that's pretty nice too, at patreon.com/nicegamesclub. Everyone's ready.
Hi, everyone.
Oh, hi, Luke. Let's start.
Oh, I jumped the gun.
No, you're good.
That's cool. I even like listened to a bunch of past episodes to get the distraction. I still did it.
You're just really excited.
No,
I
love that. That shows if you heard it and you knew that it doesn't and you did it anyway, that means that you're excited to be here.
Yeah. That's awesome.
We rarely get that kind of enthusiasm from guests. I mean, they're all very polite.
Mm-hmm.
They all say they're happy to be here, but none of them, you know, prove it in the way you just did. So
yeah.
Welcome to the clubhouse.
I'm really excited to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
I was saying before we started that I've played all of Afterburn's games, and this is one of the things that really stuck out to me. The gameplay is awesome, but also like instantly got me hooked because of tutorials. So thank you for coming on the show and talking about this topic. But let's give listeners a little bit more of an introduction to you. What's your game dev story in a nutshell?
So at this point, I've been doing game dev for more than 10 years. And to be honest, like it wasn't kind of like a calling, as in I woke up in my bed at the age of 3 and I was like, I'm going to be a game dev. I'm going to make some games. It was more like games were kind of just there as a background for all of my life, as far as I can remember. Like when I was at age 3, like we had a PC and I remember playing like Dyna Blaster or like Bomberman, depending on the region, mm-hmm. With my dad's friends. And it just kind of stayed there. Like, I remember going to a friend's place to play Doom at the age of 5, which maybe not the best choice, depending on. Yeah, it was cool. It was cool at that time. Yeah, so I just remember kind of playing games always. And it wasn't until like high school when I was like, yeah, I guess games are cool. And then I went to a technical university to study computer science, like wanting to go into games, but not like fully committed to doing that until I started doing game jams around the second year of my university. And then it just kind of went from there. Like I met a local community. I started like sort of getting acquainted with everybody. It wasn't a big community back then. Mm-hmm. Actually, like the city I'm still based in, which is the city I studied in, which is the name of the city. It doesn't have like a super robust community. It's a bit bigger, but back then you basically had like 3 companies. All of them like I think had less than 10 employees. I might be wrong on this one. So it wasn't super easy to like find a job here or something. But I managed to land a summer internship at one company. And then around the same time, I was also doing a game jam with a bunch of other people that I met through the game jam community. And that game turned out to be the original prototype for Superhot.
Oh.
That was back in 2013. We made a game. We made the prototype for 7-Day FPS,
mm-hmm.
Which was like an online event that took a week. And you had to create a first-person shooter type game for it. Somebody else came up with the design and basically assembled a ragtag group of different guys. Like we had some IT guys, I was a student. There were two like high school guys that didn't basically know anything, but they managed to make some like Blender models for the game. So it was very ragtag. But then we submitted the prototype online and it kind of blew up a little bit. And then we made a better version. It blew up a little bit more. And then we decided to... it was during the summer. So when we saw that the game was going well, I decided to... have a serious conversation with my parents that maybe this is something I should pursue. And I convinced them to let me take a gap year at my university to focus on developing the game. It was a weird year. Like I knew nothing. Like I thought I knew a little bit of programming. Now looking back at these days, I didn't know anything. But it was basically very scrappy. Like we didn't have like actual designers on the team, so we had to kind of learn from nothing. We learned how to do a Kickstarter campaign from nothing. We were like basically learning Unity at that point. Like everybody on the team had like at best several months of experience with Unity. So it was an interesting period. At the end of that gap year, although we've managed to make a lot of progress on the game, I've decided that due to a bunch of factors, I kind of want to go back and finish my education. So I went back, I finished my bachelor's degree. And after that, I was wondering like, okay, so what should be my next move? And then I moved to Warsaw, which is the capital of Poland, to work at CD Projekt. I was initially convinced by a friend who joined the team to work on the second expansion to Witcher 3, Blood and Wine. And I knew that they also were working on Cyberpunk. I was like, I liked Witcher 3. That was a nice game. And I'm guessing I can get a lot of experience there if I go there. So maybe let's go to Warsaw. Let's learn. Because one of the things I saw in Superhot was like the team was very inexperienced. Like it was still a really good team in terms of like people were super multidisciplinary and I learned a ton and I had a ton of like responsibilities, which was nice. But I knew I'm not like I wanted to improve my programming skills. Right. I knew I couldn't do them in a place where there are no like people who are better or even like a lot better than
more
me.
Experience, yeah, more senior for you to learn from. Yeah.
So I basically like aimed at the finger quotes best company in Poland in terms of like, finding a good mentor. And I felt like, oh, so they're working on Cyberpunk. I guess I'm going to go there and work on Cyberpunk. And I'm guessing they, I guess they like saw my resume and they were like, okay, so he has experience in Unity. So there's this B team that we haven't announced yet, and it's doing a card game based on The Witcher. So you're going to work on that. And I was like, okay, that's fine. But in the end, it turned out to be a really good thing because, I mean, everybody kind of saw like Cyberpunk's development was not the easiest. And my personal like experience inside was like Cyberpunk was kind of the A team. So they had like a ton of pressure on them from the fans and from the company and from everybody because they had to follow up on The Witcher 3, which was like this amazing game that won like a bajillion Game of the Year awards.
Right, yeah.
Whereas Gwent was kind of like this B team, kind of on the sides, like still like people working hard on this game, don't get me wrong, but like not as much pressure. At least it felt like that from us. Later I learned like our team leaders were like really good at like handling this pressure from different sources to make sure the development team was kind of shielded.
Oh,
so
that's awesome.
It's created like, at least for me, it created for these 2 years, because I only worked there for 2 years, a really good experience where of course like we crunched a little bit and all that, but I also like I worked under some really great people and I could see like how to lead a team effectively and how to become a better programmer. I feel like within those 2 years I've learned a lot of the skills that I'm carrying forward even today. But after 2 years, again due to various circumstances, we decided like it was a good run, but I need to do something else. And then we because I managed to save up some money, and because we've heard about some opportunities, we decided, like me and my then girlfriend, now wife, decided to move back to Łódź and start our own company because we could do it here a lot cheaper because Warsaw is like three times more expensive.
Big city prices, yep.
Yep, especially like capital prices.
Yep.
Which is not a capital city. So we managed to set up a tiny office here. And we basically said like, okay, so we have 2 years of runway with the savings we have if we're frugal. So let's try and do our own games. And if it doesn't work out, I can always like go back and like find employment in a bigger company. But let's set it up and let's see what we can do. And we had a plan at the beginning, like let's make one really short game, let's give ourselves 3 to 6 months to create a really, really small game. That's sort of our calling card. Like, let's do something we're proud of, and let's do something that we can show to people and say, like, this is the quality we can deliver, but at a really small scope. And then let's make a bigger second game. Let's spend a year on it, and that's going to be our actual game. So that was like our plan was like, let's do 2 games initially, and if that doesn't work out, let's like finish it up. So the idea was like the first game was not supposed to make any money at all. Like the first game was supposed to just like aside from being a calling card and showing our level of quality that we aim for, it was supposed to be a game that teaches us about the business of selling games.
Like, yeah.
How does it look to get a game through Steam? How does it look to like push all the like this big scary release button? How does it work to like actually get money from the stores? But it was never supposed to earn any money at all. Like, we were supposed to just release it and gain experience mostly, but we were never planning for this game to make any money and sustain ourselves. We were sort of saving that for our second game.
Sure.
And so we moved to Łódź in March 2018, and then we spent the first like 2 months-ish sort of acclimating back and figuring out everything, and then like learning how to work by ourselves. Like, well, I was learning how to work by myself.
Sure,
there was also prototyping some stuff. Mm-hmm. That prototype didn't go anywhere, actually, though that was okay. That was kind of still planned. I was trying to make like a Binding of Isaac-ish roguelike with a bunch of different mechanics that completely didn't work out.
Yeah.
Because I'm not that good at arcadey mechanics. that's not my forte. But it was during this time that I was like playing different games and like thinking about, okay, so what is the game that we can make and that has a reasonable scope? And that's when Golf Pix was born. The sort of core idea for Golf Pix was born. In a flash of inspiration that hasn't happened to me since. I don't know if I will ever have it back. But basically, like, Golf Pix was born as a fully formed idea.
Huh.
Like, it was like I was browsing some stuff and I was thinking about games we could try and maybe do. And then, like, out of this inspiration, I basically like stood up and drew like an idea for a game on a whiteboard. And that was basically like, looking at it, like, it's basically Golf Pix. Like, it has all the same elements. So there's like, it's a grid with different levels of elevation. There's a ball and there's a goal you need to get it to.
Mm-hmm.
There's cards and the cards have different statistics. And there's a bunch of different obstacles on the map that's sort of, most of them have gotten inside the game in the final version, which was really, like, really good. Like, I kind of felt like, okay, I have a full picture in mind of how I want this game to be like. And how I want the rules of the game to be like, mostly, like, of course, like during development and prototyping, some of that changed. But as I said, like, I haven't had this experience since. Yeah. And I hope I can have it again, like just this like full view of the project, even at a small scope that you wanted to, like where you want this project to get to in the end.
It's kind of like catching lightning in a bottle, I think, with respect to, especially knowing from jump how much this game is. Like it's something to it's difficult.
Yeah,
it's very difficult to get to.
But
that
pretty
point.
Amazing. But it totally makes sense that you know you kind of want to chase that feeling. But
yeah.
I feel like it's also like very important because knowing where the boundaries of the project were.
Yeah.
At least in my mind, allowed me to ascertain if it's feasible in the scope we wanted to do.
Right.
So like I mentioned before, like we wanted to do 3 to 6 months. And I felt like this is a project we can do in 3 to 6 months. Like, rules are fairly simple. It's something I can probably prototype in about 2 weeks. And I think I spent about 2 weeks prototyping the mechanics. The art style took a little longer. And I could see, like, okay, so because this is a puzzle game, we can also, like, limit the scope of the game to how many puzzles we can produce. And we don't have to do more than that. Like, we don't have to push it further. And also, like, because everything seems kind of simple, we can probably deliver on that. So we gave ourselves like up to 6 months. We started looking for an artist who could like join the team and work on the game full time. We ended up also having a tremendous luck because we have a film school here in Łódź and they have an animation course.
Oh, cool.
And through a friend, we've learned like we learned about the animation course, and we've learned like a lot of people there like are actually like really good artists, just like not even with regards to the animation, but just in general. And they've been really nice to work with. Also, like my then girlfriend's now wife initially came in just to assist me with starting the company, like with financial stuff and like with taxes and whatnot. Like she looked into that stuff. But it turned out like she's also like a really good level designer, like puzzle designer. Like it was just like during the development, at one point I was like, man, it's hard to make puzzles because I have to like program all the mechanics because I was the sole programmer on the team.
Yeah.
And it would be nice if somebody else helped with it. And she was like, okay, maybe I can help with it. And then she sat down and she produced like, I think half of the levels in the game.
Wow, that's amazing.
Which makes it even more amazing because like my wife has 2 degrees. Like she has a film, like film studies degree. And then she also is a medical doctor.
Oh, wow. And a game designer.
And also a puzzle designer. Wow. Yeah. Yep. But the last one, like, I think she could get a degree if she tried. But I think we're both done with school by that point.
Yeah, fair enough.
Maybe, yeah.
Yep. Yeah. So true to our words, like, we spent about 5 months working on Golf Peaks. Like, we wanted to launch it in 2018. So we started in June and we launched the game in November. Along the way, we've also, like, spent a lot of time, like... which is something I'm going to come back to, but like making sure the game is as accessible to people as possible. Mm-hmm. And we launched it in November initially on Steam and iOS, because when we talked to people, it looked like if our idea from the beginning was let's make this game a calling card, mm-hmm. Then let's focus on quality. Let's not do a free-to-play game. Let's do a premium game, so that we don't have to worry about monetization, right. Implementing ads and whatever. Let's just do like a normal game. and because of that, it seemed like iOS and Steam were like the two main platforms to go with. So we went with those. Through some friends, we've also like learned how to apply for featuring on the App Store. And we've done that, and it turned out to be like actually way above our expectations. Like, yeah. Golf Peaks was featured as like one of the like top new games, and like then a month after release, it got a Game of the Day on App Store. And mostly those have managed to recoup the development costs in around a month, which was, as I said, like it was completely unexpected for us. Wow. Like, this was supposed to be a game that just shows our quality, but doesn't allow us to achieve financial stability, but it kind of did.
Yeah, I'm really sorry that didn't work out for you.
Yeah, it's like, that's actually really funny because I was never envisioning that we're going to be a puzzle game studio.
Yeah,
because,
yeah.
I mean, I really like puzzle games. It's just...
You didn't know you were setting your destiny when you were doing that project.
Yeah, kind of. Yeah. It's like,
I get that.
If I would say, like, what are my favorite games, I would say, like, story-driven JRPGs or something.
Yeah.
But the games I like to make myself and also play are puzzle games. Huh. It's just I kind of lucked into making them because I was not envisioning that years ago. But basically, like, after Golf Peaks, we've decided to support the game a little bit more because it turned out well. Like, well, it did well on iOS. It didn't do well on Steam at all until, like, years later. So we did some free DLCs to push the amount of puzzles, because Golf Peaks, actually, when it launched, it was very lean because we didn't have a lot of time. It had 72 puzzles, I think. And through DLCs, we've pushed it above 100. I think it has 121 or something like that right now. And then after that, we decided, okay, so Golf Peaks, it must have been a fluke, like... It worked out for us, but maybe we were just lucky.
Mm-hmm.
So let's try this again. And so we made our second game under a very similar set of circumstances. Like, we gave ourselves 6 months. We gave ourselves, like, let's do a puzzle game. Let's launch it in very similar conditions. But let's try to push the quality a bit more, because now we have, like, some knowledge. We have some code lying around. We have some things we've discovered along the way, some... teachings that we've carried through Golf Peaks from Golf Peaks, and we don't have to repeat the same mistakes again. So let's try to make a slightly bigger game within the same parameters and see if this one also works out. And that's how Invento was born. Mm-hmm. It was our second game. It's a cooking puzzle game. And the biggest changes are, like, we pushed the art style a bit more. Like, just to like have more art going on. We've added a tiny story that carries through the game. Like there's a narrative thread whenever you finish a set of puzzles. There's like these Polaroid pictures that tell this like story of a cat family growing up.
So cute.
It's actually like really funny to revisit that for us. Like people really like it, and I also like that story we've crafted. It's just because it's a story of a single parent sort of trying to raise their kid as they grow older. It's a very universal narrative, mm-hmm. But it's really funny because when we made the narrative, none of us were parents. Relied on a general like media, a shared collective mind image of what parenting looks like. Sure. And we kind of crafted the story that felt good to us from it. And now years later that we're actually parents, it's really funny to revisit that and just see like, oh no, this experience is it's way more brutal. because we crafted like a feel-good story. And now that we're actually like raising kids ourselves, it's like, oh no, this is way harder.
Yeah.
No, that's so interesting because like, This is a bit of a segue or a detour from our main topic and kind of from your backstory, I guess. But I really felt like even though as I was arranging the puzzles in Bento, like I was maybe personifying the parent, but like really connected to the experience of the child character. You know, like the payoff of getting the puzzle was like the way that I imagined the child would feel opening up the Bento box. So it's interesting because like, you know, for a lot of parents, they work super hard and it is really brutal. And they try to shield their children from that. And the children will grow up going like, oh, really? It was tough. So that was interesting.
I'm happy it comes across. But yeah, but it's funny for us because we wanted to convey these emotions. Yeah. It's just we didn't have that experience ourselves. Mm-hmm. And now that we have it, it's like, oh no. some people complain because in Bento is actually like, it is... Like, we call all of our games, like, they're cozy or cute or something puzzle games. Mm. And that's true for the first 50-ish percent, and then they get really hard.
Yeah.
And people are always surprised by that. Which is, like, I mean, we do this to ourselves because our artwork is usually, like, very cute and comfy. And then, like, World 6 comes around, and you're like, what the hell? What is this? So yeah, that's on us. But basically, like, so we made the story in Bento for two reasons. One is the one you've mentioned is like, whenever you complete a set of puzzles, we wanted to sort of reward you with this tiny sliver of story to just not have it feel like, oh, your reward for completing this set of puzzles is additional puzzles. Just have some more puzzles. We wanted to add something more, but also like, it was also a more cynical thing where like, the problem with Golf Peaks is Golf Peaks was really hard to market because it didn't have any mascot characters or like any a lot of personality to the artwork. Like the artwork is nice, but I mean, there's a limited amount of promotional art you can make from like the same set of like this goldfish grids, but this time twisted slightly differently and with different colors. It's like it's not very marketable. Whereas if you have cute cats,
people like cats.
Then it's people like cats. So since then we've like we always have animal mascots now because it just makes our job a lot easier whenever we have to promote something.
Right. Yeah.
So we wrapped in Bento in September 2019, and we felt really good about it, and we were like, Yep, that's nice. Let's do some more puzzles again because the game again did well enough for us to be able to sustain ourselves. And let's figure out our new project. And then March 2020 happened.
Yeah.
Everybody went into lockdown. We also got pregnant around that time. Well, not me, but I mean, you know what I mean.
Yes.
And all of those things have kind of set us back in terms of like starting a new project. We've had a prototype, but it didn't go anywhere. And that kind of resulted in a long hiatus for our studio, like when we were trying to figure out what was the next thing we should do. Mm-hmm. And thankfully, in June 2021, we went to a local, because as I said before, we don't have a lot of game dev studios, but we do have a technical university, the one I attended, that has a games course. And they have a competition, like a student competition every year, where students spend a year making two games and then they present it to industry people. Which is very, very nice. Like, it's a good start because they also have people from different companies come to the university, see those games, and then judge them. And it usually results in a lot of those students getting job offers from different companies like CD Projekt or 11-Bit or Techland. So that's a really nice thing.
Mm-hmm.
And we went there and we saw a game that was back then called Train Connector. And we played it, and I was like, we could ship this game. It's a game that it's actually like, it fits our design sensibilities. It fits our mechanics. It's cranky in terms of like user experience and visuals and everything. But those things we can figure out. Mm-hmm. And then we talked to the students, we talked to the university, and after a couple of months, we managed to like suck the game into our studio. Like we actually gave the students two choices. Like either we can get the game and make it an Afterburn game and then release it as our game, or just like publish them, basically like give them money and have them set up their own studio.
Sure.
And after talking, they went with option number one, and that's Railbound. That's our third game, which we released in, well, it took us 9 months, but as students, they had 2 years of pre-production, so it doesn't
yeah. Yeah, 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 it's a little different.
Yeah, and it's been our biggest success so far. Like, we've spent the most time on it, but also, like, it did the best because it's our biggest game, our best-looking game. Mm-hmm. Also, like, in terms of, like, the player fantasy, it's... people just like trains. we way underestimated how many people like trains, and we've always been, like, very, very happy about that,
yeah.
I guess.
Yeah.
Can I ask you about that? Because you... described the initial game that the students had, that prototype,
mm-hmm.
Did not have the UX that you were looking for from your games, and you yep. improved a lot of that. Can you describe some of the some of the things that you changed in order to mm-hmm. make the game feel better for users?
Mm-hmm. Yep. So basically, like, how should I approach it? So the things we did as a studio, the things we've done in Railbound mm. are basically like the results of all the things we've learned on Golfpix and Invento. Mm-hmm. So for example, the initial prototype, like one of the things I wasn't too fond of was that it was way more open as a puzzle game. Like for example, each puzzle had way more tracks than you actually needed. So you would start a level with like 40 pieces. But you would only need like 6, for example, to solve the puzzle.
Okay.
So that gave people more creativity, but I felt like as a puzzle game, it felt unfocused. So for example, that's one of the things we've done. Like, of course, like we've sometimes intentionally, sometimes unintentionally, we've left alternate solutions for some of the puzzles.
Sure.
We've actually like, it's been kind of our bane. Not the bane of our existence, but it was like from the beginning in our games, we've always had puzzles that we thought we knew a solution, and then somebody solved them faster.
Yeah.
And then they send us an email and they're like, is this a bug? And we're like, no, you're just very smart. which always like, they always reply like very positively and stuff. But for Railbound, we actually like wanted to sort of counteract that because we knew like, this game is more complex. It's going to have more puzzles that we can't foresee. So sure. We've added achievements. There's like 3 achievements. Like one is like, you've solved one level faster than the developers intended. You sold 2 levels and 3 levels because we knew there's going to be at least 3 levels where there's that happening. And that's decreased the amount of emails because now people feel like, oh, we're like extra smart and we've foreseen that these levels have alternate solutions. But basically like that was one of the things we've approached while bringing the prototype over to like a fully released game. The other thing is, and that's where we sort of approached the main topic we wanted to talk about today, sort of using puzzles as a tool for tutorialization, which is something we're always super, super conscious about in our studio. And basically like the core idea is people don't like to read. People just don't like to read, man.
True.
There's actually like a super funny story. When we were working on Golfpix initially, and this was the first game we were making, I think a month into development, I went to like a very sort of laid back and official game dev event we have in Poland, which is called Game Dev Evening. And basically it's kind of like a weekend drinking party for people in game dev. Like, it's very laid back. There are some talks, and they're actually super nice because they're very, like, most people have, like, a beer and they're not, like, super rigid. Like, they can talk freely about their projects.
Sure.
Like, like, usually when you go to a conference, it's hard to get, like, actual insights unless you know somebody well. But here, in this informal atmosphere, it's much easier to just say, like, hey, so you did this thing, like, with Apple. Was that hard? Was it easy? Like, how did you do it? Or, like, so did your last game sell well or not? Because and then you can get actual advice. So I actually went to the event with a prototype of Golf Peaks that was like a month and a half into development, just to get people's opinions and figure out like how they enjoy the game. And as I was going and showing the game to the people there, I realized what a prototype we had. So basically, like, the game opened and there was like level one. It was like, and then the first thing you saw was like a text pop up that said like, hey, welcome to Golf Peaks. This is a game about golf and puzzles and cars and stuff. click on this card to select it and then swipe. And then it was even worse because we had a worse input system back then. It was like, you had to tap once to select a card. You had to tap again to select a direction. There were like four directional buttons on the bottom. And then there was like a launch button, like, so you had to press three buttons in order to play anything. And it felt horrible.
Yeah.
But the worst thing was just the text boxes. And I mean, for the first like seven levels, like every single one of them started with a text box. So the first one was like, hey, welcome to Golf Peaks. And the second one was like, oh, so now you have two types of cards. And this card does that, and the second card does that. The third one was like, oh, now there's a water tile, and the water tile works like this. Yeah. And as I was going around and putting my iPhone in people's hands and having them play the game, I just like, whenever a text pop-up showed up, I just like saw the enthusiasm just like go away from the
voice. Oh, no. That's why playtesting like, is so important, as you're displaying here.
And as I was just doing that, I myself started getting embarrassed. So I started like skipping those text boxes for people and just like telling them instead, because then they would be more engaged. But it was basically like a 2 day long, very harsh lesson about the fact that people don't want to read and people want to understand the game, but also like they don't want to, especially in an environment like a casual environment, because it's different if like somebody downloads the game and is like sitting fully braced to play the game.
Right.
But if somebody's like casually interested in the game, like they want to be introduced to it as smoothly as possible.
Yeah.
And that's where sort of our core philosophy for using puzzles as a core tool for introducing people to our games has emerged. Mm-hmm. And we've sort of been honing that ever since.
I need to get a new shirt.
Uh-huh.
I think I may have mentioned this before, but like I've had the Nice Games Club t-shirt, which is soft and wonderful. I've had it for years, and it's now starting to, starting to fade the logo.
Oh, no.
And so I'm really excited to get a new shirt.
So this call to action is specifically for people who bought the shirt many, many years ago.
Of course you did.
And need a new one.
Yes. Yeah.
If you don't have the shirt, I mean, fine, you can get one.
Yeah.
But this message is not specifically for you.
Right.
Right. Well, it's like, because it's the same place where I got it last time, right? I can go to nicegames.club/shirt and I can find it and I can order my next one. And then I'll have two and they'll both be soft and I'll slowly turn my wardrobe into that of a cartoon character where I wear just the same thing every day. The Nice Games Club t-shirt and probably some pants or something.
Probably some pants or something. That's not a ringing endorsement. I don't know what is.
That's nicegames.club/shirt.
Work takes up most of your time. That's why you should use stamps.com to save time with your mailing and shipping and have flexibility to focus on more important things. Stamps.com can handle all your mailing and shipping needs with rates up to 88% off USPS and UPS. Add flexibility to your day with Stamps.com. Go to stamps.com/program to sign up for a special offer. No contract, cancel anytime. That's stamps.com/program.
So basically, the core idea is whenever we're working on a game, we split our games into worlds. So there's like world one, world two, world three, or like chapters, whatever you want to call them.
Sure.
And world one is always like reiterated from the very beginning of development all the way until like a day before launch. Like mm-hmm. we always push, like world one has to be like super hard. And I'm never like fully satisfied with them either. Like I always see like we could do things better, especially like now that Golf Peaks has 6 years and I've had more time to like let it simmer in the back of my mind, like which things we did well, which things we did wrong. I think I would redo it again if my wife wouldn't stop me whenever I filmed the idea. There's more issues because like the game has been out for so long. Like if we change world one, then players would be like, what the hell?
Yeah.
And it's like all the YouTube tutorials are like not applicable anymore
because the games have changed
and stuff like that. But basically, like, we've always pay a lot of attention to World 1 to the point where we do, like, a map of, like, this is the screenshot from Level 1, and this is the... And below, we always have descriptions, like, these are the concepts that this level introduces.
Mm-hmm.
This is Level 2. These are the concepts. Level 3, these are the concepts. And, like, we always, like, focus super hard on making sure, like, this sort of progression through these early levels happens both at a reasonable pace where if somebody's good at puzzles, they don't get bored, but also at a reasonable pace for people who are not good at puzzles and want to engage with the game. So we always try very hard to find a balance between making sure the game is not too slow and not too fast to be able to accommodate different types of players. And the big idea behind that is we want to make sure we introduce the concepts that are necessary in any given time in the order that makes sense. So using Golf Peaks as an example, like Golf Peaks has a bunch of core game mechanics that we need to make sure the player has retained before we finish sort of world one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we sort of try to strip it down to like, which are the most fundamental and which ones, for example, like rely on other concepts, because then we need to push them a bit further. So for example, like in Golf Peaks level one, like world one, level one, we only require you to basically swipe the screen once in a given direction. Like the fact that the cards are used there as a game mechanic is not relevant at all at this point in time. The fact that the hole is like, well, the hole is important. So the core concepts we focus on, like world one, level one, are you swipe to interact with the ball, and you need to get the ball to the hole. And we do that through like a floating hand tutorial, which mimics the motion of the mouse or the finger. If you're using a gamepad or a keyboard, it's more difficult because we need to show you two prompts.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, like we do like a worldless, super easy tutorial. It's like, just do this thing. And we've made like a lot of work that we put into the game is made makes sure to reinforce those core concepts and make them as easy and as satisfying as possible. So
yeah.
For example, in level one, you cannot fail. Like you can soft fail, but you can't hard fail. In Golf Peaks, you can soft fail if the ball is like on the field, but it hasn't gotten to where it needs to, but you can also hard fail by falling off the cliff. So for example, level one is designed so that you can't do the hard fail, just to make sure that players don't get like discouraged at the very beginning.
Right, that makes sense.
The cards, initially you had to select them manually, but during development we realized it's actually nicer if we auto-select the first card, because then we can also use that on the first level where you only have one card, because if it's auto-selected, you didn't need to click it. You can just swipe the finger to use the card that you have already selected, and by that we've saved one click using that.
Sure.
And that also makes this level simpler and more inviting to players. Mm-hmm. And of course, like when you actually make the right move and you put the ball in the hole, we also celebrate that by doing like a confetti. Like whenever you finish a Golf Peaks level and you get the ball to the finish, there's like a big confetti that splatters on the screen. And all of those are just to like give you an instant dopamine hit.
Yeah.
So like, okay, I did something good. Like ball needs to go here. So we sort of use that. So we've isolated the core concepts, like ball needs to get here and you need to swipe to do that. And those are the only two we focus on a level.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next level sort of reinforces that. So what we do is like we do concept introduction and then concept reinforcement. So whenever we've introduced something, there's a good chance that the next level is going to make sure that you've actually understood the concept that you were just shown.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So for example, in level 2, you need to swipe in the other direction to make sure that you've understood that the direction of the swipe matters, and it's not just like a I don't know, it wasn't an accidental swipe.
Yeah.
Level 3 introduces a new concept, because now we can do, like, for example, selecting cards. And then level 4 checks if you've understood the concept. It creates a puzzle where the order is necessary. Mm-hmm. Or, like, no, level 3, I think, introduces that you can do multiple moves and then selecting cards. And then from that, we sort of build a vocabulary of things that we've taught you. And then at some point, we introduce puzzles to act as, like, gates and also, like, exams. So, for example, like, level 9, the last level in the first world of Golf Peaks, takes pretty much every concept that was taught to you during world one, during previous levels, and makes sure that you've understood all of them. Because once that's done, we can then start layering new concepts. Mm-hmm. So we always, like, pay a lot of attention to making sure those are introduced in the right order, and they teach the things that we actually want to teach you. Because sometimes, like, two pitfalls that you can fall into, one is you can try to introduce a concept, but through that you can actually, like, mislead people and show them a wrong thing. So, for example, you might want to show that, okay, the water mechanic and Golf Peaks. I'm using Golf Peaks as an example a lot, because I've done, like, lectures for students on that using that particular game as an example.
Sure.
So, for example, water and Golf Peaks has a bunch of a bunch of rules associated with it. So, for example, like, if a ball falls into the water, it respawns, but it respawns on the tile it was last placed at. So, like, was last standing at, and you can use that to advantage in several puzzles. But one of the puzzles that we had teaching it at some point in the game, like, made people confused about those rules. So we had to rework it to make sure that the actual things we want you to look closely at are conveyed in this specific instance.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I was going to ask actually about that. Because I'm curious how you changed the. Well, I'm curious both how you ended up misleading players into not understanding how the water worked, and what you did to fix that, to solve that issue that people were having.
So whenever we sort of mislead people by accident is usually when we focus on, like, we want to convey one idea, mm-hmm. but they sort of figure out something else instead. It's probably easier for me the game we're working on right now called Pop Champs.
Yeah.
Is also a puzzle game, but this one is a tactical puzzle game about dogs playing football. And the idea here is it's a puzzle, but it's also a turn-based strategy. So you have these, like, dog units. They all have a limited amount of stamina, and you need to move them around the field and pass the ball between them so that they can shoot a goal.
Sure.
One of the mechanics we have in the game is there's, like, two types of kicking. It's actually very similar to Golf Peaks in some way. There's two types of kicking. There's, like, you can kick in the air and then pass through obstacles, but it only lands in a specific spot. And there's a ground kick, which goes close to the ground, and you can decide where it stops along the way.
Okay.
And sort of one of the puzzles we've made for that game in the demo, we wanted to emphasize the fact that you can select where to stop the ball so that so for example, you had a range of 4 tiles, and you could stop, like, at 2 or 3 tiles.
Yeah.
To make it easier for another dog to pick it up and then go and shoot using that.
Okay.
That was our design intent. But what actually happened was it was easier for people to, like, it was more intuitive for people to realize, like, okay, you shoot not in the air, but you shoot along the ground. So the thing you want me to understand is that another dog can intercept the ball. Almost everybody that was playing was instead, like, they positioned the other player where they wanted to intercept the ball and then kicked to intercept the ball, which was, like, it wasn't a mistake, but it was the wrong thing we wanted to focus on, because later levels, you couldn't do that. Like, you couldn't do interception. You had to, like, actually use the UI to select the tile you wanted to stop at. And people didn't get that piece of knowledge because we failed to introduce it properly before.
Sure.
Like we thought we introduced it, but actually like we confused people more. And then when they arrived at a harder puzzle that relied on this piece of knowledge, they didn't have the piece of knowledge.
Right.
Ah.
So then what's the resolution to that?
Yeah.
Yeah. So the resolution is like to look at it, at the puzzle closely and like figure out like, well, you can actually do two things. Like you can rework the puzzle to better focus on the concept you want to introduce. But for example, in this specific case, we've actually took a longer look at it and we were like, okay, so it's more intuitive for players to do the interception. So let's maybe do the interception. Like let's maybe change this mechanic so that you can't, like you don't have the separate UI, which is kind of confusing and also annoying on gamepads that allows you to stop the ball whenever you want it to. Like, let's maybe change the mechanic to only work with interceptions,
okay?
Because that's more intuitive for players, and that's the route we went. We went with. We actually like we reworked the mechanic to not have a set range. It actually has infinite range now, so it's even more powerful in this regard. But you can't decide where to stop the ball. You need to use the other players to do that. It actually allowed us to create more mechanical depth in other areas.
Cool.
That's also something we've gotten from playtesting. So yeah, playtesting good.
Yeah,
yeah.
Playtesting
yeah.
good. Always.
Yep. But the second pitfall is whenever you instead of like confusing players by doing the puzzle, like by teaching them something else, the second pitfall is when you sort of want to teach a concept, but mistakenly cram too many concepts into a puzzle.
Yeah.
So that's the other reason why we do those sort of level maps.
Yeah.
Well, we don't have a name for them actually. So like we do like we phase out the progression and under each level that we say like this one introduces concept A and it reinforces concept B and it maybe reinforces concept C. So just to have a good idea of like what this puzzle actually like what makes this puzzle tick. And if we realize like, okay, so but actually this puzzle introduces concept A, but it also introduces concept D, then we take a long look at whether we can separate those two concepts, because sometimes some mechanics are interlinked in a way that makes them really hard to separate.
Sure.
And just to make sure like we don't pile too many things on the player at any given time. So for example, like when we had this initial prototype for Golf Peaks, like it was extremely guilty of that. Like at that point, like it could introduce like five new, like completely new concepts to a player in a given level, and all of those would be necessary to solve a puzzle. Because at that point, we were like too eager, like we were too trusting that people would like force themselves to understand that.
Yeah.
But now we've gone the opposite way. Like we most of the time, unless it's like the first puzzle in the game, usually has to introduce more than one concept. It's really hard not to do that because like they are there. But what we can do is we can try to de-emphasize the ones that don't matter at this point. So for example, the one I've talked about before, like Golf Peaks has cards and you select those cards in order to play, like you select the order in which you play the cards and those sort of represent the moves you make. But the problem is the cards are not necessarily relevant until you have multiple of them. So what we do in Golf Peaks is we also select the card because then you don't have to click on it.
Yeah.
And then the card itself kind of is there on the UI, but it becomes transparent. It like it doesn't matter up until a point where we actually manually ask you to select a card in order to play them in a specific way.
Right.
And at that point, we sort of draw the attention to the fact that they were always there. It's just, we don't want you to notice them. We don't want you to worry about them until they're relevant in a given puzzle.
Right.
Yeah, and I can totally see that being, I could see that being a case where you have the cards there from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
So you would be resistant to not explaining it or having a special version of it where it's not doing anything or it's auto-selecting. I could see the resistance to doing it that way because it feels like, oh, well, then they're going to learn the wrong lesson from that. But it leans into your bigger lesson, which is just the one thing at a time. And and so when it shows up, that I think it's not that big a leap for the players to be like, oh, I saw that. Now I know what that means. But I didn't need to know what that meant until now. And I think that's a really good lesson. Because I could also see what you were saying, like an early level, you're trusting players to learn three or four concepts early on. And I think that's a mistake. But I also could see that coming from a place of, I don't want to waste my players' time I also want them to get to the good stuff as soon as possible, because players not only have no patience for reading, they have no patience for tutorials. And so there's a real push and pull, I imagine, of like, we have to give them these boring step-by-step ideas. And you don't know necessarily how exciting that will be to a player who's never seen the game before, because it might be thrilling to learn those things one by one, but it's hard to know that. Mm. So let me ask you about like that push and pull. Like, is it something that you can validate with playtesting? Because I could guess maybe sometimes you can, but maybe sometimes you just have to go on like, this is, you're taking an educated gamble on the balance between those things of like getting to it as quick as possible, but also not moving too fast.
Oh my God. It's always a struggle. and you would think like after 6 years and after 3 shipped games that have been like very well received by people, we would be better at it. and by God, we thought we were better at it. But as our latest game, PopChamps, shows, it's just, well, it's also like the most mechanically complex of our games. Yeah. And it definitely gets more and more difficult as our games get more complex.
Sure.
We hope they won't get more complex than that.
Yeah.
But basically, there's always like this, we want the player to get to the good stuff, to the exciting stuff. But there's just like, but on the other side, like we need you to really like to have those mechanics seep in, because if we push you through the game too quickly, then it's going to create problems later down the line. It's going to create frustration. So for example, in PopChamps right now, we do not introduce enemies, like enemy units that are also playing on the same pitch as you until like world 3. And it's a constant source of struggle, because like football is a team versus team game. Like, right. We want you to be able to see the enemy team as fast as possible, because that's football.
Yeah.
But also, like, but it has just so many mechanics to introduce before that. Like, you need to figure out, like, there's a unit. Unit can move. Unit can kick ball. Obstacles, you need to avoid them. You can have multiple units on your team. They have different statistics. Stamina is important. Kicking range is important. Yada, yada, yada. It's just, you have all of these concepts like passing, and then if you pass to another player on your team in a specific way, it's like changes their direction, and that's also important. All of those things are important, and we can't introduce enemies really unless we like go through all of these things first. And then like by the time we've sort of massaged it to a point where we wanted to, you're in world 3, and some people don't get that far.
Right.
Yeah, so it's really hard.
Yeah.
But like as I said, like it's all a matter of like it comes down to playtesting, and it's also coming down to like making sure that we prioritize those really well. Yeah. Like for example, one of the things we thought like is crucial for people to learn at a specific point in time is a mechanic where like you change the direction of the player when they receive a pass. Because it opens up the game a lot in terms of design, and it allows us to do a lot of interesting things.
Mm-hmm.
But as we've been showing the game to people at Gamescom, on the show floor, like actually looking at them engage with the game, like a lot of them didn't get to any of the later mechanics because we've lost them along the way.
Sure.
And so we've started talking about like, okay, we spend a lot of time introducing these other like players on your team and introducing their mechanics, but maybe it's not as necessary for you to complete the team early so that we have more of these tools in your belt. Maybe it's more refreshing to the player if we would introduce like a hazard, like long grass that you can lose the ball in earlier, so that they can see, okay, the field is gonna, like the pitch is gonna evolve, right, and the enemy team is gonna evolve. All those things are gonna evolve. So it's a matter of like figuring out which things are gonna, like, we of course we need to introduce some concepts, we need to like lay down the foundation so that we can use it later in the game, but maybe like let's add a bit of spice every now and then so that the people don't get bored. Mm-hmm. That's something we are very like conscious of,
yeah,
most of the time.
That's kind of that's the part of the thing about tutorialization that I don't know that gets talked about enough, is that like it's also the player's first experience with the game.
Yeah.
And so you want, like, ideally, I think every developer wants their players to continue to play the game fully, right? So you want the tutorial to also hook players enough so that they want to continue engaging with the game.
Right. You're not just promising, here's cascading complexity as you work your way through the tutorial with the promise of later fun.
Yeah.
It's like, here's a thing. Here's why it's fun. Have some fun.
Yeah.
Here's the next thing. Oh, here's a, you know, surprise.
Right, yeah. Right.
And then we'll worry about the cascading complexity. I mean, not every game can build itself up the same way, but they all have to keep the player going because you are playing the game.
Right.
You're not reading the rule book.
It's not a separate thing.
You've actually hit on a bunch of things that are something we try to be conscious of. So one of those things is at like right now we have a bunch of different things in our arsenal that we can use to sort of try to re-engage the player. So for example, one of the things we do is we try to make you more engaged by using those rewards for completing puzzles. Like in Invento, we've sort of shown you an illustration whenever you complete a full set of puzzles.
Yeah.
But in PopChance, for example, we felt like, okay, like we wanted to do a more involved story, but also like we felt we want to push this a little bit more and like utilize it a little bit more to reinvigorate you even like during the world. So for example, one of the things we do is like there's an introductory comic and then a bunch of levels, and then there's a comic that sort of adds some story but also ties into the mechanics you're currently doing, so that we can do multiple like illustrations in a single chapter to make sure like, okay, let's lift you up a little bit more, let's like reset your brain and have you prepared for these new puzzles. And also like whenever we do introduce a new concept and then we reinforce the concept, and we try to also like every now and then throw you a puzzle so that you like, the big thing we're trying to achieve as we're creating these, especially the first worlds in our games, is for you to not feel like it's a tutorial. That's sort of the end goal we are trying to go for. Like, so that you don't feel like, I've spent 50% of this game and I'm still playing a tutorial. Whenever I think about it, it's like Xenoblade Chronicles games come to my mind, especially like... Especially Xenoblade Chronicles 3 is like one where you're in hour 60 of this 100 hour game, and then suddenly you get like this new battle system, and there's like a big ass tutorial for it.
Yeah.
And it feels like every 5 hours, like, hey, here is a tutorial. So what we really try hard to achieve whenever we're designing our games is like not to have it feel like that, like not have you feel like, oh, it's world 5 out of 10 and I'm still being tutorialized, like I'm still being talked down to. It's more like, no, like you get a tutorial-ish puzzle that introduces a new concept, and then we sort of check if you've gotten the right lesson from it, or like we expand or like twist it a little bit to show you something more. And then a puzzle, and then maybe another puzzle, and then a new concept, and then reinforcement, and a puzzle. So it's like, it's kind of like an ABC. So like, we teach you a thing, and then we check if you've learned the thing, and then we do an exam where there's like no hand-holding to see if you've gotten the thing. And also like we also like try to twist the new concept using old mechanics. So like introduce it in a setting where there's like these old mechanics to see if you've actually like gotten it and can do something fun with it. And we sort of interplay that all through, like, our games.
Yeah.
I think it's delightful. So, I remember experiencing that. And one of the things that I do in my career is I do instructional design work. So I'm taking those same concepts where you're like, okay, we need to make sure people can actually do this. And you can't be sure that someone can actually do a thing if you just introduce it to them and then you just do it once, right? You have to let people practice. And every time I opened up a new puzzle and it was showing, you know, and I realized when I looked at the puzzle and I realized what it was asking me to do, I'm like, oh, I know this, but it's different. And it's like it's delightful to discover that little connection that you make as a player is, I think, at least for me, it's really delightful. So I think it works.
Yep. We always try to do something like, the first time you see any given mechanic for the first time, it's introduced in a very safe environment. Mm-hmm. Like, usually, like, there is no other way to do this except for the one we've laid for you. And if you, like, figure out what the designer intended, then you can see, like, the mechanic in action. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we need to like we need to do it across multiple puzzles, because sometimes a mechanic is too complex to just do one puzzle and have it have you like get it whole. But basically, like, we try to sequence it so that sort of it's kind of like baby steps. Mm-hmm. Like the first time you see it, it's very like safe and easy, and then the next one is like you can fail, but it's a simple fail, and then later it becomes like more and more challenging.
Yeah, that pacing of the concepts and experiences leads into like a larger design question, which is how big and how complicated the game is entirely. Because one of the, like the example you're citing of games that just sort of like mid, you know, you've been playing for hours and suddenly a whole new thing shows up.
Right.
I know Breath of the Wild, oh no, is it Tears of the Kingdom with its parrying mechanic.
Oh,
felt
yeah.
like it came in a little bit too late for me. And because in that game, I felt like I figured it all out.
Yeah.
And I've been playing the game for a while.
Right, right.
So
right.
that's a question then, is a game where you want to have this depth, this complexity, but you also have to make sure you're not overwhelming people and you're pacing it out. But you also don't want to keep everything changing all the time. You want them to be comfortable with these new ideas before you introduce the next one. How do you avoid that instance of a player who's like, okay, great, this is the game I'm having fun with, and then they do a couple levels, and then now they're introduced to a new idea, and they're like, ah, I figured it out. I was having fun. I don't need this. Because even though they may not understand, they're going to have more fun once they understand that. How do you avoid players getting too comfortable with the knowledge they have when you try to introduce new knowledge to them?
So I would say, like, we do it, like, we solve it in two ways, I would say. Mm-hmm. So one way we solve it is we usually separate the game into these worlds, and they are also separated by mechanics. So, for example, mm-hmm. world one is always the foundation of the entire game, like the core mechanics we want you to learn. Then world two we usually introduce like one new mechanic to twist it. So, for example, Golf Peaks, world two introduces launching the ball into the air, whereas previously it was just rolling. Mm-hmm. In Bento World 2 introduces locked tiles that you can't rotate. Railbound World 2 introduces tunnels that you can use as shortcuts on the level. So we always like introduce a new mechanic, and then like, I don't know, Golf Peaks World 3 introduces water. World 3 is sand. World 4 is water. World 5 is bouncy springs, and then world 6 is portals.
Mm-hmm.
So like each world has its own mechanics, so they're like compartmentalized. And of course, like once you introduce a mechanic, like if you're in Golf Peaks world 4, then you're gonna get sand and you're gonna get air and you're gonna get everything that was before it. But of course, like we usually introduce it, so like the first levels introduce the new mechanic and then we twist it using the old mechanics. So that's one way we're doing it. So we always change the color palette. We always like change the setting a little bit when we introduce new mechanics. So you're kind of, you know, that you're moving into like a next section of the game. But the other thing we do, we didn't do it in Bento, but we did it in Golf Peaks and Railbound, is especially in Railbound, is we do bonus puzzles. So mm-hmm. in Railbound, we have this thing where there's like a main path of puzzles sort of handcrafted by us to ensure that you can, like, most people should be able to get through them. So the first level in the world introduces the new mechanic, and then like level 2, level 3, level 4 would like introduce increasingly difficult varieties of this mechanic, and then, for example, levels from 5 to 12 would create twists on this mechanic using already existing concepts, like already previously introduced mechanics. But then from those, like from this golden path that leads into the next chapter of the game, we would have, like, for example, from level 6-5, we would have a level 6-5A and a level 6-5B bonus levels that are sort of not necessary for completion, though you get an achievement for completing those.
Yeah.
But those introduce more difficult puzzles that are not necessary for you to complete to go and like finish the game, but you can always like go and do them. And that's one of the ways we try to give you like more puzzles that are concentrated on those mechanics you might have enjoyed in the past.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's kind of like you warn, like, we're moving on now, player. But like, if you're not ready to move on now, player, you got a little bit extra. Yeah.
No, it's like, I would say like every main path in each chapter has about 10 levels. but then we might have like 20 levels in the whole chapter. So
right.
You get some extra content. And even in like chapter one, the extra puzzles can be really difficult compared to like what you're doing on the main path. And that's also intentional. So that's also intentional because like, as we were talking about earlier, like some people are just better at puzzles and some people need some more time to get some concepts. Mm-hmm. So whenever we see like somebody just blazing through the first puzzles and be like, oh, this game is easy, like it's game for babies, then we say like, okay, so like this level in the first one, like let's try this one. Yeah. And then they're immediately humbled. Then they know like the game has more to offer. It's just we can't show you everything yet.
Right, because if you don't know everything, or if you go in and the game just you explained it earlier, like if you go in and introduce five different concepts at the beginning, people won't be able to.
It's too much.
Parse that it'll be too much.
Yeah, and then you lose the fun of discovery. So
yeah,
one of the things we also do is I'm like a real stickler for making sure the experience of our games is very sort of unencumbered. Mm-hmm. So for example, when you launch any of our games for the first time, there's like, well, there's the company logo and like a Unity logo or something, but basically like you get thrown into puzzle 1-1 immediately. Mm-hmm. Like you don't go through the main menu, you don't go through anything else, there's no like login with your Afterburn account or something. Nobody would use that. You just get like, you get thrown straight into the puzzle and without any text, like it's just the initial puzzle with like a textless explanation of what you should do in this level. So you're getting thrown straight into the game and you don't even get out from that into the main menu until you finish world one, unless you decide to do it with the UI, or if you quit the game and then relaunch it, then it throws you into the main menu. But basically, like the experience I want to have for the people who launch our game for the first time is you get immediately thrown into a puzzle. Well, I guess Invento and PubChamps are a bit different because you have story at the beginning. Like you have a little bit of story, you scroll through it, and then you get to the puzzle. But basically, I want you to get to the meat as fast as possible and just get on with it and not worry about anything else. And then you leave into the main menu, and then you might see in Rayalon, like, oh, there's more puzzles. There's like 10 more puzzles that I can do in this world, or I can go to the next one and then continue playing it.
Yeah, that kind of, I mean, it's a good button on the whole topic, which is like, the barriers to tutorialization is friction.
Yeah.
And so anything that's apart from the design itself that can be used to lessen the friction services everything else in the game. So, you know, you win in multiple columns, I think.
Mm-hmm. For sure.
I do feel like there's a lot of stuff that can be gained by friction. Like, I have a lot of respect for other like hardcore puzzle games like Steven's Sausage Roll or like Baba Is You.
Sure.
Yeah.
even a Monster's Expedition can get there sometimes. Although this one is like closer to ours. But I feel like you can get a lot by friction. Like, for example, one of my favorite puzzle games of all time is Snakebird, which is a ridiculously difficult game that doesn't look like a difficult game at all. But I mean, I feel like it's just my core philosophy is different. Like, I want as many people as possible to enjoy our games. Also at the same time, like, I get a lot of messages or emails, people saying like, oh, I was really enjoying Invento and then I stopped playing, like, I don't know, like 2/3 through the game because it just got too difficult. And I'm like, yeah, that's good. That's good for you. It's like, that's not a problem. That's not something to be ashamed of. Like, if you buy any of our games, just play them for as long as it's comfortable for you. And if you don't finish them, that's fine. Mm-hmm. We've started going back to all of our games and adding an unlock all puzzles button because one is for convenience. Like, people, I don't know, like change systems or like change phones and their saves are not always transferred.
Sure.
And if somebody wants to continue the game after some years, I want them just to be able to like see the whole story or like play any of the puzzles they liked. Just I like when people just play the games we make in the way that fits them the best.
Mm-hmm. I like that perspective a lot.
You can add like friction as a design element in a puzzle.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as like software design, that's anything you can do to do that, then you can save all that frustrating energy to deliver to a player when it actually matters to their enjoyment of the experience.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Cool. Serve up, you know, allow people to get into the headspace where they can play with their own frustration. That's our show. You can find Luke online at afterburn.games. For show notes and additional links from today's conversation, go to our website, nicegames.club. Visit us on Threads at Nice Games Club, where Dale posts about game dev resources and flame arrows. Apply there on Threads or email us, contact@nicegames.club. Nice Games Club is on Patreon. Support the show and get stuff, including ad-free episodes. Sign up at patreon.com/nicegamesclub. And if you want to keep things more casual, just stop by nicegames.club/discord and say hello. That's it for this week.
So, until we start again, remember to
play nice
and make nice.
Steve, I'm going to give us a little bit of room tone just for your sake.
Thanks.
And...